So I wanted to start out by asking you if you could tell us what started it for you in Dharma life. Can you remember?
Well, I suppose it depends how consciously we're talking here, because I can look back and see, you know, when I was about five, kind of looking up at the ceiling of the chapel in my convent school and sort of going into dhyana with these sort of silver stars that there were against this sort of blue ceiling. And then in my teens, as well as having the usual kind of existential, what's it all about? Oh my goodness, we're on a tiny lump of rock in the middle of an alien, you know, vast universe, and is it all meaningless? As well as all that, I also did seem to be trying to meditate before I knew what meditation was. And so I'd be walking very slowly and reciting phrases and noticing how I got into different states when I did that. And then when I was about 15, I came upon this book about yoga with an outline of somebody meditating on it. It was sort of, we were on holiday in Cornwall. There were all these Agatha Christie crime novels and things, and somehow amongst it was this book about yoga by Ernest Wood. Of course, not very much at all at that point. I didn't know what yoga was, but I knew I had to have that book somehow. So it took me about 3 days to kind of pluck up the courage, because I wasn't sure what it was. But then reading it, just the idea, it had the sort of Shantideva idea that there are two ways you can be happy. You can either be happy through, you know, arranging everything so that it suits you, which seemed like a demanding project, or you could work with your own mind so that whatever happened externally, as it were, or you were still fine. So it was like the covering the world in leather or wearing a pair of shoes, you know. So that seemed to start me off. And then when I was 18 and came up to Cambridge, I learned Transcendental Meditation, which the Beatles have been doing. And that got me, I found that very relaxing, and I got quite sort of blissful doing that. I'd read, when I was about 17, I started reading around the library and I got to the comparative religion shelf. So I was reading about Taoism and Hinduism and Buddhism. But what I read about Buddhism was incredibly dry. But I remember reading the Four Noble Truths and the Fire Sermon, as it was called, and a few other things, and being very convinced. But I didn't want to be a Buddhist because it all seemed, yes, very dry and analytical. Yes, I could only really kind of cope with it by reading quite a lot of that. So Taoist mystics and Hindu yogis as well. But then at the end of my time at university, I was in a complete state. And I had, in my second year at Cambridge, I'd come across this book about Tibetan Buddhism called The Way of Power by John Blofeld. And that was the first thing that I read which combined all the kind of clarity of Buddhism with the richness and symbol and kind of magic and all those sort of deeper aspects of mind that I had a strong feeling for. So at that point, I actually wanted to be a Buddhist. And so having come to the end of my 3 years up here and, yeah, being a total wreck, which I'm sure we haven't got time to go into. I went up to Samyaling, which at that point was the only Tibetan Buddhist center in Europe. Akon Rinpoche, who was the Lama up there, he had me meditating. Well, I'd been doing transcendental meditation maybe 20 minutes once or twice a day. So he started me off doing, he said, "Have you done any meditation?" I said, "Yeah, I've been doing this transcendental meditation." And he said, "Oh, well, you know, if you've been initiated into it, keep doing it. And if it doesn't work for you, I'll give you something else." Which I was really impressed by, because he wasn't just saying, nasty Hindu practice, here's a proper Buddhist one. But he said, "Okay, start doing, tomorrow do 4 hours, and then the next day do 4 hours, and then build up an hour a day from there." So I did 4, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So I'm sitting, I wasn't in any fit state to meditate really for 12 hours a day, but I was sitting slumped against the shrine room wall with this mantra going on for 12 hours a day. And while I was there, I also met this guy called Eric Wright, who had long blonde hair and a guitar, and he'd just come down from Findhorn. And he told me about this group in London called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, who sounded quite interesting. He later became Mangala. Yeah, so I spent several weeks at Samyaling and then came back down to London where I was living and tried to carry on my practice on my own. But then that was, yeah, it's difficult to practice without Sangha. And the lowlands of Scotland were a long way away when you had very little money and transport links weren't very good. So at the beginning of 73, I came along to our little centre in Archway, Punderica. That's kind of how.
That's how you got to the front door.
Yes. So I think something in me was always kind of connected with something with meditation from quite an early age in a funny kind of way.
And what happened when you walked through the door of Punderica?
It was a strange time to walk through the door of Punderica because up until the end of 1972, Bhante had basically led all the classes and all the retreats and given me all the talks. So in the autumn of 72, he gave the lecture about tantric symbolism, creative symbols of the tantric path to enlightenment. But then decided that in 73 he'd take a year out. Oh. So he went off down to Cornwall on sabbatical. So I turned up, I think, either on week one or week two of this little handful of very new old members, having been thrown in the deep end, to lead the classes. And I think it was maybe the second week I went along, it was either the first week or the second week, we had a question and answer session where there was a question about the precepts. So the order members were there, they just put their heads together to make sure that they'd actually got the five precepts right. And there was also, I asked a question, you're called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. What does it mean to be a friend of the Western Buddhist Order? Which is a question you'd think you might get. So they had a little think about that one as well. And after a while, Vajradhaka, who'd led the beginner's meditation very well, quite charismatically, he said, well, if you're a friend of Bhante's, you're a friend. And that's obviously how it had been up until 2 weeks ago. Basically, you came along and there was Bhante and there was this group and this order, but fundamentally everything was focused on him. So you made a connection with him and that was your kind of link and you became a friend. But this Bhante person had gone off to Cornwall and I wasn't even sure I could be a friend of the Western Buddhist Order. And, so it was, they weren't very impressive and, fair enough because they hadn't been practicing for very long at all. I'm still stunned that Bhante felt he could throw such inexperienced troops into the front line like that. But things did grow and it all did work, so.
And you stayed?
And I stayed. I suppose the reason why I stayed was that although they weren't very impressive in terms of their knowledge of the Dharma or depth of practice, they were nearly all, the people that I met to start with, were nearly all sort of young, really enthusiastic, energetic, really wanted to practice. And that was me as well. Mm. Yeah, and mainly kind of from that kind of hippie background. So yeah, I kind of, in that way I sort of fitted in very easily. And also it's not like there was a lot of alternatives in London at that time. There was the Buddhist Society, which had a reputation for being a bit staid and and a few other little things, but very little. So. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine now.
Yes, very hard. So who would you say was the first order member you really met or got to know or had an effect on you?
Well, there weren't, as I say, there weren't many. Even when I was ordained a couple of years later, that brought the active strength of the order up to 44, I think. So, there weren't many around. I mean, Vajradhaka, I got to know and appreciated a lot, and he became one of my Kalyana mitras in 1974 when the mitra system was started. He and Sabuti were the other ones. Mm.
So was there something about him that you particularly responded to?
About Vajradhaka?
Yeah.
I appreciated his... He was intuitive and his energy was quite... It was free in a way that I really responded to because mine wasn't at that point. He was very encouraging. And even though he hadn't been practicing that that long. Yeah, there was a depth to him in terms of, you know, talking about meditation and that kind of thing that I could feel, which I appreciated. Yeah, I had him and Subhuti as Kalyan Mitras because they were very different and quite a good balance. And
what would you say about Subhuti at that time?
Well, he wasn't ordained at that point, which is why he was ordained at the end of 1970. Yes, at the end of that year when I came along. I met him earlier in the year. We used to have these weekend communication exercise events. So Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon for two or so hours, the big communication exercises, which were, well, they were quite something because, you know, there were a load of really, you know, young people in there, maybe in their 20s, with loads of energy, quite a few of us with a background in kind of encounter groups and things like that. So, and they were mixed. So, you know, there's nothing about single sex at that point, which meant you could, you know, sit down opposite somebody who you really liked the look of and kind of stare into their eyes, you know, for 5 minutes as you go. But yeah, I remember sitting and doing a communication exercise with Alex Kennedy, and it was incredibly complex. I don't think either of us began to have any idea of what was going on. And I just felt like, oh, it could take the rest of our lives to sort out, you know, the depths and the complexity of what's going on here. And it probably has, so, yeah.
I'm just thinking a lot of people listening to this won't be familiar with communication exercises. I wonder if you could just describe what they involved.
Yeah, sure. I mean, sometime, I don't know when it was, maybe it was in the 1990s, they went from being things which people used to enjoy, from being a way of kind of clearing the Buddhist center. You know, you announce that in, you know, the second half of our evening, we're going to do communication exercises, and everyone suddenly remembered they had urgent appointments they had to go to and disappeared at the tea break. Yeah, there were some exercises that Bhante introduced into Triratna. I think because he felt that coming back to the West, he met a lot of people whose emotions really weren't very free at all, and certainly weren't very positive. So he put an awful lot of emphasis in the early days on positive emotion, but also on freeing energy. So that whole tantric series, you know, was an attempt, you know, partly I think to, you know, really kind of get people's energy moving, and, you know, things like that tantric version of the five precepts and things like that, which were all framed in terms of energy. And, so communication exercises were another attempt on his part, I think, to help people to free their energy and make it available for Dharma life. So they involved three exercises. First one was just looking. You just would sit with somebody and just sit and look at them for about 5 minutes with nothing said. The second one was one of you would take one of a number of sentences, such as, water is wet, the cow is in the field, do birds fly, and so on. And you'd have, as it were, a dialogue with the person you were sitting with responding by saying yes, or okay, or all right. And quite quickly, you know, water is wet, you know, doesn't have great depths to it as a statement. So very quickly, you know, the phrase itself, the rational meaning of the phrase gets kind of exhausted. So then it becomes more like a sort of energy tennis where, you know, one of you is putting across some energy and the other person is kind of affirming that energy and in a way affirming the person who's saying it. So in a way, when it works well, yeah, there's a build-up of energy and a freeing of energy, and you get people, you know, saying this sentence very kind of tenderly or very strongly and all kinds of things. And then there was a third exercise where you both take one of the phrases and have more like, as it were, a dialogue, a sort of more equal exchange. And in between the exercises, you talk about them, how you'd found them. So actually, they need to be really well led, because if they weren't, and if you had people who hadn't done them much before, it's just very embarrassing. You know, you sit there and wonder about what somebody's thinking about you, and then you do this weird phrase for some reason or other. But if you've got somebody who's good, they'll help you to kind of get into a sense of what it's aiming to do, and they'll demonstrate ways in which it's not working, and it can be all quite sort of, they can do it in quite a light, quite a funny sort of way, which just, once you build up a sense of, you know, kind of trust and a bit of relaxation in the room, then they actually do, you know, really release some energy. And you could, you know, certainly over those, you know, like 2-hour sessions or 4 hours on the weekends, you know, you come away with a whole load of energy, and having actually felt like you had really met somebody quite deeply, quite fast, you know, you didn't know what they worked at or what they believed or anything, but just on a straight kind of meeting another human being level, they were good.
And that's how you really met Subhuti.
That's how I really met Subhuti, yes. Yes, indeed.
So Subhuti and Vajradhaka become your Kalyan Mitras.
Yeah.
This is you becoming a Mitra?
Yes, I was one of the first few Mitras, along with Kamalashila and a few others.
So, in 1974?
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you come to ask for ordination?
I'm not sure that I ever really did. But I think it must have been early 74, I moved out from where I was living with my girlfriend and moved into a community in Balmore Street, just down, a few doors down from where the Buddhist Centre was, into a community with... they would have been ordained by that point. Subhuti, Lokametra, just been ordained a few months, really. Padmapani, who wasn't Padmapani at that point, just moved out, so that I had a room to move into. There were various other people around while I was in that community. So Kamashila was there for a while, Devametra, a few other people, Bimlametra some of the time. Yeah, so I've moved into that community, and I think at some point I did say to Subhuti something like, why aren't I ready for, why wouldn't I be ready for ordination? But I think that was the nearest I got to, you know, asking. So I was very cautious in those days, so, you know, probably asking it directly might have been my way of doing it, really. But maybe they managed to read the signs.
So there's obviously something that happened
after that. Yes, because then I got invited. I was doing a social work course at that point. But I got invited on... There was a summer retreat followed by... Was it followed by an ordination retreat? Can't remember now. Anyway, we didn't have a place of our own, so we'd hire places... So we hired a place called Four Winds Sufi Farm in Surrey for our summer retreat, on which these six ordinations were going to happen.
And that was?
That was August 74.
August 74.
So I'd been around at least nearly, what's that, just over 18 months. I suppose I had a bit of Buddhist background before that, but not much.
Gosh. So at some point along the way, in this trajectory, you met Bhante for the first time.
Yes, I did. He was mainly down in the West Country on sabbatical. I think I did see him. He must have come to London at some point. I think I saw him at Punderica, because he just was there, you know, before a class. But the first time I really met him properly, Subhuti arranged me to go up to Norfolk, where Bhante moved after, Cornwall. Bhante was, he was moving from one place to another, and Subbuti arranged for me to go up and help prepare to move, but also to spend time with Bhante. So I stayed in the old rectory in Titwishaw, which was a place that we had connections with through a woman called Mary Rawnsley, who became Sulochana. And I went to, I was driven up to Norfolk by another early order member called Dhruva. And yes, I stayed in the rectory and went over to the cottage where Bhante was staying. And yeah, he was living there with Vajrakumari, before he was Vajrakumari. So yes, I spent quite a lot of time, I think over a couple of days, just sort of a lot of the time talking to Bhante. I did a bit of work around the place. I remember cleaning their stove at one point, which I must say nearly put me off. The whole idea of being involved with the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, because it was disgusting.
So do you remember what the experience of first meeting Bhante was like? You'd heard about him, but then you actually met him. Do you have a sense of the impression that you made at that point, or what it was like?
Well, yes, I do. I have quite a strong sense, but it's funny because I can also see just how my sense of him at that time was filtered through a whole lot of preconceptions and expectations. So I'd met Akon Rinpoche at Samuel Eng, and he'd had me as a newcomer meditation 12 hours a day. So I kind of assumed that, you know, somebody like Bhante would be meditating at least 26 hours a day. I had all these images of sort of Buddhist gurus. And yeah, Bhante was, he sort of lived up to them and completely didn't live up to them at the same time. Worst of all, from my point of view, because I had all these, you know, I'd read all these far out things about, you know, Tibetan lamas who could do all kinds of advanced things. I also, as well as assuming that Bhante must spend all his time meditating, I also assumed he could probably read my mind. So if you want to spend the most excruciating couple of days, spend it sitting in a small cottage in Norfolk with someone who you imagine can probably read your every thought, particularly when you're, you know, you're kind of very young and very shy and very kind of caught up in yourself. It's hysterical looking back. It's so fun. Yeah. So I think I was looking for lots of sort of magic and mystery, and there were bits of that, but what I mainly got was a lot of quite some common sense, sound advice, which is what I needed at that point. Yes. So I think it was that first meeting, as I say, I think I was so bound up in myself that I don't know that I really got any kind of a real sense of Bhante.
Mm.
I probably got more of a sense over the succeeding kind of few months, up to and around ordination, and then, you know, as the years went by, I got much more of a sense of him.
Mm. So going back to your ordination, you just mentioned going up to ordination, I wanted to ask you about your name. I wondered if you could say something about your experience of receiving it, or what your relationship with it's been, or anything really. That...
When Bhante first gave it to me in the private ordination, he'd just given me the Padmasambhava mantra, which had a very strong impact on me. And so then he said, the next thing is the name. And all the six names had come out in Pali this time. So at that point, I felt disappointed because I definitely wanted to be called Vajra, Vajra, Vajra. So he said, I've decided to call you Vasantara. So I had this initial, I didn't want a Pali name, and what's that about? But then he explained it to me, and I immediately kind of bonded with it, because he talked about, firstly, about meaning universe within or everything inside. And I felt as if I'd been quite seen somehow with that. But but he had a good sense of who I really was behind all the shyness and confusion that I was manifesting at that point in my life. He gave it to me as a sort of precept almost. It was like, he said something like, you don't need to go outside yourself. You don't need to look outside yourself for anything. Everything that's really important, even enlightenment itself, it's all within you. So that was a kind of precept that I came out of the ordination ceremony with. And he also told me about how it's related to the Sutra Jataka, which is this previous life of the Buddha. It's called the Great Jataka in some southeastern countries, where Vasantara is a prince, and he makes a great vow that he'll give anything to anyone who asks him. So it all starts off okay, beggars ask him for money and he gives. But then after a while, people catch on to the fact that that's what's happening, that he seems to be just prepared to give anything to anyone who asks him. So they start asking for jewels and elephants, and he goes to the royal treasury and just hands things out, to the point where the people of the country go to the king, his father, and say, look, you're going to have to stop him, because we're going to have the IMF down on us, because we're going to be, national debt is increasing by the day as he practices generosity. So the king calls Vasantara and says, this is very good, my boy, what you're doing. But got to be sensible, and enough is enough, and got to learn to draw lines. And Vasantara says, no, I've just made a vow. I'll give anything to anyone who asks me. So he gets banished. And as the story goes on, he gives away his chariot. And because this is ancient India, he gives away his children and his wife. And in some versions, his eyes. But then it's all restored to him in the end, because it turns out that the person who asked him for his children and his wife was this divine being who's testing him to see how far he'll go with his vow. So it's all restored to him. And they all live happily ever after. So I kind of came away with this name, which had a lot of richness in it, and I can feel, being a preceptor, I've sort of, because of that, I've almost kind of wanted to find names for people that I've ordained that have got kind of layers of meaning rather than one simple message almost. So there's this mixture of something about going inside, mining within, and finding treasures, and then sharing them with other people. Mm. Yeah, and I've, to some extent, lived from that, I think.
Yes.
And it's felt very, my name's been fantastic, actually. It's been a real... I'm so grateful to Bhante that he gave it to me. A lot of people assume that it's connected with Tara, but it's not, actually. It's Antara means within. So but it just happens to have Tara in it as well, which is one of those...
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, one of those lovely things, because I've done it. Awful lot of Tara practice over the years as well. I think the names sometimes have a sort of shadow side to them though too, because I think if I got myself into trouble over the years, it's been kind of giving without any sense of where my limits are in terms of energy and resources and that kind of thing, and then at times kind of bouncing back into being quite internalized in a particular not very healthy sort of way either. So So it's interesting. But yeah, it's really given me just that precept about, you know, not needing to search outside for things. You know, that in itself has been a very good thing for my whole life. Yeah, no, it's been great. And yeah, it was a kind of myth. It wasn't just a name. It was a myth to live by, that name. Yeah. Yeah, very grateful to Bhante for that and for a lot of other things.
So I was interested, you mentioned, yeah, Tara's kind of hidden in your name. Well, not very hidden, but yeah, sort of hidden. And you said you've done a lot of Tara practice over the years. Yeah. And you said that when you were ordained, Bhante gave you the Padmasambhava practice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if there's something you could say about the unfoldment of those connections, or, well, clearly you started out practising the Padmasambhava sadhana and then other things happened.
Yeah, quite a lot of other things happened. what can we say about all that? Well, when I was ordained, like most people, I didn't know that much about the different practices. We did have that tantric series that Bhante had given. But, yeah, most of the early order members didn't know a lot about the different figures. In a way, when I wrote Meeting the Buddhas, which became those guides to the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and tantric deities, I kind of wrote the book that I would have liked to have had when I was ordained. So we're in the ordination ceremony, when we got to the thing about, you know, what practice I'd do, I said I didn't have a strong feeling for anything, any of the figures. I didn't know that much. But I felt I was quite sort of lazy and I could probably do something quite sort of energetic and Vajric. And so I don't remember Bhante talking about it. He didn't talk about Vajrapani at all. He just said a few words about Vajrasattva being about purification and Padmasambhava being about spiritual energy. And suddenly we went, oh, right, Padmasambhava then. And so I started in the Padmasambhava practice. And I don't think I had a particular talent for visualization practice, but for some reason I had a very deep confidence in that kind of practice. So when I started, it was very much, you know, the visualization aspect was very much kind of like painting by numbers. But over the years, just by keeping going with it, that aspect and all the other aspects have really, you know, opened out. So it's become a very natural way to practice now. So I was completely devoted to Padmasambhava. And then there was a order convention after I'd been ordained for a couple of years where Bhante talked about the different practices a bit and said that if you've been doing one practice for a while, you know, at a certain point you might want to take up another practice to balance it up. So if you've been practicing Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion, you might want to take up Manjushri to develop more of the wisdom side of things. And I thought, no, you know, give me, you know, a few kalpas, you know, a few 100,000 million years, you know, practicing Padmasambhava, that will do me. But then one night when I was in Brighton, I had a dream where I was given the Tara practice, which I talked about in Guide to the Bodhisattvas. And it was so strong and so clear and so, you know, even to the point where when I was waking up with the mantra going on, this voice off says, "Oh, actually, it's the mantra now, you've had the initiation." I wrote to Bhante and told him about it, and he said, well, it obviously corresponds to something quite deep in you, so you should do it. But the strange thing was that when I didn't want another practice, and if you'd asked me the night before I had that dream, you know, so you've got to choose another one which you're going to have, Tara would have been the last one I would have chosen. Okay. Absolutely zero feeling for Tara whatsoever. But then, you know, I did start practicing it, and a lot of the time it had me in floods of tears, absolutely floods of tears. And I said that to Bhante, and he said, oh, it doesn't usually have that effect. And I thought, oh, it's me, you know, it's just like... But yeah, I think it really, those two practices, that combination of all that sort of energy and the sort of magical quality of Padmasambhava and taking the Dharma into the depths, and that kind of combination of compassion and active, you know, giving and going out into the world, they seem to work very well for me for a long time. Well, they still do. Although these days I've done a lot of other practices over the years, and I suppose in the early days when I did those sorts of practice, each one felt like a very distinct, discrete, almost like going into a different world. Whereas now it feels more like, well, there's just enlightenment, which can manifest as Padmasambhava or Tara, and one of them may sort of more explicitly seem to be demonstrating some aspect of enlightenment, but they all have them there completely. It's not like, you know, Tara is more compassionate than Padmasambhava, or, you know, Padmasambhava's, you know, goes deeper into the depths than Tara or whatever. That's not like that.
Do you do different practices at different times now, or how does it play out in your life now?
I do. These days I do a kind of one practice which feels like it includes all of them. Because actually any of them includes all of them. But yeah, I mainly do one practice. But then I've ordained a whole lot of people who've taken up different practices, so if I'm giving somebody a practice, then I'll do a lot of that practice. If I'm doing a retreat where we're doing pujas to particular figures, you know, I'll do the practice. So there's one practice which is now like, you know, my sort of heartbeat practice. But then there are others which sort of weave in, and there are some I just do from time to time just because I feel like it. Or just feel moved, you know. Or they turn up, that's the other thing. It's not like doesn't feel like I'm doing the practices these days, so it's sometimes different figures appear, but even if I'm doing my main practice, actually it feels as if all the time there's a mandala of all kinds of figures that I've focused on over the years that are all present. And in a way, if I'm leading a retreat, it's almost like I'm inviting all of that spiritual richness to be present, you know, wherever we're doing the retreat. And in a sense, it feels like those spiritual energies, or whatever you want to call them, they do the retreat, and I just sort of sit back and marvel and cheer them on.
So you mentioned there a couple of times your main spiritual practice, which I get a sense, well, you said it was like a heartbeat, the sort of ground base or something. I was wondering if there's more you would say about that, or if you would rather not.
I don't know how specific I want to be, but I suppose in general, if my practice these days is, well, it's just wisdom and compassion, really. So it's a mixture of, I still do a lot of sadhana practice. I still do a lot of that kind of visualization and mantra recitation. But I also do a lot of just formless practice as well. So just, relaxing completely and not asking mind to do this or that. I suppose, the wisdom side of it is seeing that they're, well, let's go the other way. The compassion side of it is hopefully being of benefit to beings on different levels, which is external and also a lot of the time internally, in some ways being, generating well-wishing. And the wisdom side of it is seeing that all of this that I'm generating well-wishing to, and everything that I'm engaged in, is completely ungraspable, and so there's nothing to worry about, put it like that. Because it's a bit like seeing the dreamlike, all those Mahayana images that you get of, you know, life being like a dream, like a magician's illusion, like a, you know, like a rainbow, etc. Yeah, it's seeing that at the same time as really caring for everything that appears. Which all sounds like I'm dwelling in something very advanced all the time, you know. But along with that, you know, will be the mornings when I just feel grumpy or whatever. But yeah, the practice is kind of more does itself these days, and that seems to be what it's about. It's about constantly opening to the love that seems to be available in the depths of a human heart mind, and at the same time not getting caught up in things through seeing that it's all just appearances, and it's much more like a dream than we realize. And those two kind of working together more and more and more.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had with you a few years ago when I was here, and I asked you about your heart wish. And you quoted William Blake with the Proverbs of Hell.
Did I now?
Eternity in love with the productions of time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, that would be... I'd still stand with that as a statement. Yeah, I think it's about the nearest I'm aware of in our culture that expresses... how I feel practice is, what I feel practice is about.
I'm aware it would be fascinating to just carry on or go back and pick up a kind of chronological story, because there's so much that it's just lovely to hear, but obviously we are in the thrall of time.
Yeah.
I wonder if I were to say, as you look back over the last... was it 4 decades? 5, more than that.
Yeah.
In terms of your spiritual life, your Dharma life, are there particular points that really stand out that you might describe as, I don't know, in terms of the landscape, the really noticeable, whether I don't know whether it be turning points or how you describe them, what comes to mind?
I think I could pick up on all sorts of things, unfortunately. There's a lot in all those years. I suppose if, when I look back, I'm struck by some of those early days when we were just getting more of the infrastructure of Ratna off the ground, you know, so the early days of, you know, getting the right livelihood together and communities together. Some of those feel very special now. Particularly when I was in Croydon in the early days with Naga Bodhi, we seemed to strike oil in Croydon from a Dharma point of view. It seemed like things just unfolded incredibly fast.
So what was in Croydon in those days? What era are we talking about?
We are talking about 1977 to 78, really. And I'd been by that point, I'd already been chair of the Brighton Buddhist Centre. But I moved up to... I wanted to do more meditation, and I moved up to Purley, which is just outside Croydon, to Ariatara, which had been our earliest community, which is a sort of house, nice, large... suburban house, a nice garden, very, very lovely shrine room. I moved there because I wanted to do more meditation, and at that point it was kind of Sleepy Hollow, it was kind of very quiet. And people were saying, well, why haven't we got a place in Purley at all? You know, we haven't got places in all sorts of major cities, and Shouldn't we just close it down and go and start something in Liverpool or somewhere? But Nag Bodhi, who had become the chair, he sort of dreamt a vision of having taken the Dharma to Croydon. So, which is, you know, big sort of suburb of South London. And there were four of us order members there, including myself, Nag Bodhi, Padmaraja, and Jyoti Parla. And Jyoti Parla was learning Chinese, I seem to remember. So yeah, there was very little happening. And there were like two men and a dog coming onto the classes. And we were thinking of making the dog a mitra because they were more, it was the most promising of the three of them. So it was really, really dull. But we decided, no, let's see if we can make the whole thing happen. And within about a year, we had classes of 60 people coming along, and we also started getting right livelihoods going. So we had as well as Padmaraja, who's working as a film editor at the BBC, bringing his salary and putting it into our common purse, which we used to have. We followed this, give what you can, take what you need. So if I was earning £5 a week and somebody else was earning £10, 10 times as much, well, we'd all just, I'd put my £5 in and they'd put their £50 in. And we'd all take, you know, what we needed. So as well as that, we had Jyoti Parla started a painting and decorating business. We had a removals business, which Roger Hilliard, who became Padmotra, was doing. And then after a while, we managed to get a place in West Croydon where we ran first a vegetarian restaurant. First a whole food shop and then a vegetarian restaurant with a community up above. And all that happened incredibly quickly. And I think partly we were a talented team. And we were all good at teaching meditation. But I think we were very good at giving people a sense that it really was their center. So they really kind of, it didn't feel like this is a place I'm coming along to learn about meditation. We managed to create this sense of, no, we're a sangha, we're a community, we're practicing the Dharma together. We're all really involved in this. So people really took ownership of it. Whilst at the same time the order members would kind of feed that enthusiasm. Okay, now we've got this going, we could do that. And then we keep feeding a sort of vision of how it could be. And it just mushroomed. It was great. It was very exciting. Yeah. And it was a very full-on, full-time Dharma life. You know, we worked together and you'd get up in the morning, practice together, work together, and then everyone would eat together and then do a class together in the evening, and then you'd get up and do it similar day the next one. Yeah.
So how long was that phase or era?
Well, I had two parts to it. There was a phase which was probably only about 15 months or something, because then I took a bit of time out and went to the London Buddhist Centre when there was a final push to get that open. Mm. So I went and worked there for about 8 months.
So you were doing building work?
Yes, I was, for which I must say I was horrendously unsuited. I did building work for a while, and then Jyoti Parla and I painted out the entire place. And then I went back to Croydon for another period of about 18 months. But by then, Nag Bodhi had moved on, so it felt a bit different. But it was still, you know, very alive and a lot of energy around.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I look back on that, particularly that first part of that Nag Bodhi and what we did then very, very fondly.
Mm.
And it's a shame because there were, you know, subsequently Croydon had its troubles and that era sort of all tends to get a bit sort of written off. But the early part of it was just very creative and very positive and very good.
Mm.
And another passage in my life I look back on with fondness is probably 81 to 86 when I was Bantu's secretary along with Subuti. Found in my life by and large that if I've really made wishes, things have worked out. I haven't always been very wise in what I wished for, but they've usually tended to come true. So I'd always wanted to kind of live closely to, you know, to a Buddhist teacher and really, you know, not just to see them on retreat, but actually to see how they live their life.
Mm.
But by 1980, there weren't that many older members, but there were, you know, 200 or 300 or something. So really, I couldn't see any particular reason why I would have the opportunity to see Bantia very up close. But I got invited to be one of his secretaries. So I spent 5 or 6 years, you know, just seeing him most days and just watching how he lived. And yeah, I learnt a lot from that.
And that was at Pavloka?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And yeah, so I learnt a lot of practical lessons about, I suppose, yeah, how Bantu approached things and the kindness and the thoughtfulness with which he approached a lot of things. And, you know, we'd have lunch and supper with him and we'd have all sorts of Dharma discussions. So I learnt a lot about Dharma, and also I learnt a lot about a whole lot of, you know, cultural things, because he knows so much about literature and the arts and so on. But yeah, mainly I suppose I learned from just watching how he lived, and he was extremely disciplined, you know, day after day after day, you know, he could follow the same routine. But I never felt that he was sort of like stuck in it. He could also then decide, oh, you know, I'm going down to London for a few days to visit some art galleries and go to some second-hand bookshops, or, you know, I'm going off to give this talk here or that. But then he could just pick the routine up again. And so he never seemed tense. He always seemed quite relaxed in doing it. But he just made very, very, very good use of each day.
So was that a time when you felt you really got to know Bantu?
Well, I think I'd started to. I think the ordination, you know, I felt like I met him as a sort of spiritual being there, or even on that retreat before I was ordained. He had an awful lot of energy, a sort of energy connected with the Dharma. I remember the day before I was ordained, I was just watching him, well, you know, a lot of retreatants standing around and Bantu talking to something. And he just made a gesture which almost knocked me over from across the room. He had a lot of energy on some levels. And people see him now, you know, you think, oh, Bantu, you know, it's almost like you have this image of him almost having been Bantu the old man, and you kind of know that he wasn't, but you don't really kind of remember that, you know, he used to kind of, you know, go around the villages, you know, teaching the Dalits about the Dharma, and if there was nowhere to stay, he'd just sleep in the fields, you know, in Dhammarakshita, and then he'd walk and get to the village and walk to the pandal, the podium where he was going to give his talk, and nobody could keep up with him. And he had, I suppose, when I got to know him, he was in his 40s, but even then he had a tremendous energy, which wasn't just a sort of physical energy. It wasn't, you know, that he was could run 10 miles, you know. There was the energy of a mind that, yeah, just had a lot of spiritual power to it. And it was partly very, very mindful. I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's quite so obviously, carefully mindful as Bantu. which I think is partly why now, you know, in his 90s, his memory is still very good and very clear. And he would, you know, he would be very absorbed. You could feel it. You know, so he'd been working all morning and came down to lunch at Pamaloke, and you could feel this, you know, sense of him sort of emerging from this well of concentration on whatever he'd been writing about. And there were times when, as his secretary, I'd sort of have to disturb him in the middle of, you know, when he was writing. And I kind of knock on the door and this voice would say, "Come in." And it would almost feel like there was this kind of wall of energy or something which you had to sort of break through in order to kind of reach him. I half expect to sort of bounce off it and end up back outside the door again. And there were times where, yeah, you didn't have to be particularly sensitive to feel that he was in a very kind of refined sort of state. I used to lead retreats at Pamaloke. I also sometimes organised them. And there was one that I was doing where the shrine room was in the main house, sort of at that point, and it was meditation time on one of our silent Christmas retreats, and Bhante was upstairs in his study, and he was playing music. And the retreat leader said, "Oh, Bhante's playing music quite loud, and I think it's going to disturb the meditation. Can you go and ask him to turn it down?" So I thought, "All right, I'll go and ask my guru if he can turn the music down a bit, please." So, same sort of thing. I went and knocked on his door, and this voice came in, "Yeah, come in." And I went into the room, and it was like, it's almost like he wasn't there to start with. I mean, he was sitting in a chair, but it's almost like his body was sitting in the chair, but he was somehow in the kind of in the room, but sort of a bit pervading it, and very, very refined. You know, it was like he was just these, I think he was playing Handel or something. Yes, that T.S. Eliot thing about "you are the music while the music lasts." You know, it just felt like he was the music at that point. And so I had to, ask him if he'd mind if I turned it down, which of course he didn't. But yeah, there were times where, you know, he was just very obviously in very different, very refined states.
Mm.
And they're very concerned a lot of the time, you know, to act out of metta rather than, you know, putting any pressure on people and all kinds of things. I think sometimes people now, you know, just not having had experience of Bhante in the early days, so they have a sense of him as, you know, this sort of old person who we're grateful to for founding Sri Ratna, who has his flaws and, you know, it's sort of, it's all this sort of area around his sexuality that's caused a lot of difficulty. I don't think they always realise that along with those flaws, there was some incredible strengths and an incredible sort of energy, which is what started Sri Ratna, if you like.
Mm.
Again, it's sort of more kind of something which came through him, so to speak. It wasn't. I mean, the everyday personality was difficult to navigate, and although, he had incredible strengths, and just being so well read and being able to go out to so many different kinds of people. But in a way, there was something which came through Bhante, which was really special, which really was full of Dharma qualities, and that's what started Sri Ratna.
So him embodying the Dharma.
Yes, because, otherwise, you can give good lectures and so on, but that doesn't really move people to put their whole lives into following you, I think to really kind of inspire people in the way that he's inspired people, you have to be embodying the Dharma to a large extent, which doesn't mean all the time, and it doesn't mean that you're completely worked out. I do think that is been unskillful in some ways, but at the same time, there's also been these very strong Dharma qualities which have come through.
I guess it's that territory of caught, not taught.
Yeah. Mm. Although I think Bhante's been, he's managed to also teach very well, but it is about being, it is more of a spirit of something or an energy or qualities, I suppose, qualities which come through from a person or through a person, which aren't about what they say or they are about who, what they can contact. It's about the depths of them. It's about somebody who is living from those depths or someone who has those depths too.
Yes. Well, it's making me come back to you, thinking about you talking about your name. And the way that you're describing how much you've caught that from Bhante. And I know from my own experience and from the experience of many of my friends how you are being that for us, because we haven't had that kind of contact with Bhante, and obviously people won't now. So it's the flame passing on, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we all have to be as open as we can to taking as much of that warmth as we can, and just keep passing it on. And on a certain level, it's about us, but fundamentally, it isn't about us. And I have a Tibetan Lama friend called Dayabhen Pashe, and he's a highly respected teacher in the Gelug tradition, and he makes this distinction between the sort of like the foreground of a teacher and the background of a teacher. So when people sort of focus on him, he kind of says, well, don't focus on the foreground, don't focus on the personality or how I do things, focus on the Dharma that's coming through. And I think it's the Dharma coming through, which is the flame which needs to keep passing on. And I think we need to take into account the wholeness of a person right down to the everyday things. But with Bhante, I feel like what's going to endure will be that flame that he passed on, and that those qualities and that energy and that that Dharma, and the foreground will gradually assume less and less importance as time goes on.
So you just mentioned a Tibetan Lama friend. I know you've got a number of friends, or I don't know if you can give us friends or teachers in the Tibetan tradition. I wondered if you could say a bit about that.
I could say a bit about that. I suppose, it was Tibetan Buddhism which drew me in originally. I suppose I probably would have ended up being a Buddhist just because it was right, it was how things are. But I would have been dragged kicking and screaming into the Dharma until I came upon Tibetan Buddhism. Because I suppose being a universe within, I always had a sense of there being other levels to mind, and the Dharma needing to really communicate to and from those deeper levels. And yet Tibetan Buddhism has collected a whole lot of methods for doing that, which, go back to India, go a long way back. But at the same time, I'm not sure how Western or Eastern I identify as. I think I'm probably a bit non-binary in that area. But, I was in a Western culture, and I couldn't see that Tibetan Buddhism was going to be introduced in sort of wholesale into the West. So I was always interested in how Buddhism could express itself in Western culture. But at the same time, I did seem to have this ongoing connection, whether it's a karmic connection or whatever, with Buddhism and its Tibetan expressions, at least some of them. But once I decided that I was going to become deeply involved in Sri Ratna, I let go of my connection with Samya Ling and just happily got on with being part of Sri Ratna. And it wasn't actually anything that I did which took me back into the Tibetan arena, really. While I was at the London Buddhist Centre, I had a strong image, vision, whatever you want to call it, of another Yidam, and asked Bhante if he could give me the practice. And rather than him saying, "Oh yes, I'll give it to you," he suggested I went to see Dada Rinpoche, who's his teachers in India, who in his turn sent me to this Lama in Germany. And because practices like that, in a way they unfold, so it's not just like, oh, you know, here you are, do the practice, giving it to you now, goodbye. Because they unfold, it's helpful to have someone staying, well, witnessing you're going for refuge using that practice, to put it in Sri Ratna terms. So as that practice has unfolded, I've kept you in contact with this Lama Daya Brimpashe. And teachers become friends and friends become teachers, maybe sometimes. So I've kept up that link, and that's been there for over 30 years now. And also, there aren't that many people around who are obviously who've devoted their lives to the Bodhisattva ideal. So when I meet one, I tend to want to stay in contact with them a bit because, they're treasures. Mm. And I feel very fortunate to have met Bhante, who's definitely done that very, very strongly and clearly, but to have met one or two other people as well like that. So. Mm. Yeah.
I think I remember you describing you actually met Tilman, as I think you refer to now, but I think it was Lama Lundrup at that point, at Majumaloka.
Yes, I was invited, this was one of the disciplines, just to be in context, in 2007, I think it must have been, when Majumaloka and Birmingham was our central Trivatna place where Bhante was living. I got invited on a seminar there in connection with their study program, Dharmapala College, to go on a seminar with this Lama Lundrup, which was his monastic name, although now he's disrobed. He calls him, he's gone back to using his German name, which is Lama Tilman. So it's Lama Tilman Lundrup. So he was invited. He'd met Dhammarati and Parami at the European Buddhist Union, and they'd got on very well and felt like they had quite a lot in common, and they'd met Subhuti and they'd got on well. So, he got invited to Majumaloka to do this seminar because he translated the Jewel on the Liberation of Gampopa into German and knew it like the back of his hand. And a group of us were invited to sort of have dialogue with him around the seminar. And while we were doing that, Lama Tilman's main job in his Sangha, he did 7 years of his own retreat, but then he was asked by his teacher to be a retreat guide for men doing the traditional 3-year retreats. And I think when I met him, he guided 4 of those, so he'd done 7 years of his own retreat and then 13 years of guiding other people. So 20 years of his life had been about long retreat. So we were just asking him questions about it, you know, how they did them, what the benefits were, what the difficulties were, because it wasn't an area which we particularly explored in Sri Ratna. And in him talking about that, it stirred in me the part which had always wanted to do something like that ever since I'd read the songs of Manarepa way back when. Because I'd lived at Vajraloka and I'd lived at Kukuloka.
But he's part of a Kagyu lineage.
Yeah, he's part of the Karma Kagyu school. Yeah, his teacher was called Gendun Rinpoche, who was sent to the West by the 16th Karmapa. So I asked Lama Tilman if he'd be prepared to guide me in retreat. And he said, yeah, he's sure he would. And I talked to Bhante about it, who to start with, he was quite open to the idea of me doing a 3-year retreat, but he couldn't quite see why I'd need to be guided. Whereas I was quite clear that I felt I'd want guidance if I was going to do something like that, because however much experience you've got in meditation, there are always the blind spots, there are always the things that you don't see about yourself, there are always the tendencies to move in comfortable directions rather than to face the one thing that you don't want to look at. And I just think it's more efficient to have somebody with a lot of experience guiding you, because, yeah, life is short and you don't want to waste time. So after a while, Bhante certainly was sort of reconciled to the idea. I'm not sure he would have recommended it, but he came round to it. And he was even talking about Vijayamala and I, because Vijayamala was also being pioneers. So that was nice. Yeah, so the 3-year retreat, and then seemed to come out of that retreat really, really, really wanting to share what I'd, well, share more Dharma. So I've
certainly done that.
Done my best, yeah, over the last years now. Six and a bit years.
And you have an ongoing connection with Tilman as well, then?
Yes, he's very much a friend. Because he'd come and visit us regularly while we were on retreat. He wouldn't come that often, maybe every 2-3 weeks, something like that. But he'd come and spend most of the day, and so we'd do some study together, and he'd go into what was happening in the meditation in detail and make suggestions. And he wouldn't leave until, as he put it, he'd hoovered up all the Dharma questions. But he also talk about himself. He was just very open about himself and what was happening in his life, and he was going through big changes. And so, yeah, he just became a very good friend.
So would you say your Dharma practice changed significantly as a result of this, didn't it? Those 3 years?
Yeah, I think it did. I think it became much more relaxed. I think I came out of it much more confident in the Dharma, even more confident. I had a lot of confidence before, but it felt as if it just went to a greater depth. I think probably because of my personal tendencies, but maybe also the way in which we approached meditation in the early days of Sri Ratna, there was still ways, subtle ways in which I was kind of forcing things or in my practice or wanting to make things happen or being too goal-oriented in a way which was really unhelpful. So I think I unpicked all that, which was good. And also in 3 years, you really get to know yourself even more deeply, because you're just sitting with your mind for 8 hours a day or whatever, which also means that you encounter all the kind of depths of those kind of really unskillful, unhelpful, well, those really sort of powerful emotions which kind of drive most of life. You know, if you look around the world at the moment. Yeah, you can see, you know, what's driving things in a lot of ways is greed, is hatred, is insecurity, is fear, is pride, and so on. Yeah, I could name various names or, you know, different situations where that's very obvious. But those have such a tremendous kind of power to them. And all that power all comes from individual people's minds. You know, it's like whatever happens in the world, you know, it's like somebody invades somebody else. Well, that all starts from, you know, an idea coming out of an insecurity and a, you know, or a hatred of the others, or a sense of entitlement to that piece of land, or a desire to be seen as the great leader and the one who did it. All the, you know, it's all just in an individual or a group of individuals. So, you know, if you really go and sit with your mind, not only do you get clearer about how things are and the nature of things, and a lot of opening happens, but you also can really go into the depths of those sort of dark wellsprings of, yeah, what's really kind of what poisons life. And that's when you take the Dharma into those places, then that really has a very strong effect on you. But I think it also gives you the possibility of being able to help in ways that you couldn't before, because partly, you know, most of us are kind of on the run from ourselves because we don't want to go into those places. But also there's a lot of energy that's liberated through turning the energy that's caught up in those things and being able to use it for the Dharma, being able to use it for the good in different ways.
So would you say you have a different experience of your energy? That's a bit of a vague way of putting it, but talking about freeing up energy. And I'm just thinking, this is to bring in another idea, but Bhante talks about this idea of a super personal force, or a different kind of energy. I just wondered if there was anything in that area that you might say.
Yeah, I suppose I have a kind of paradoxical sense of energy. It's like, I'll be, what am I now, 67? So it's like my physical energy is definitely a bit less than it was, you know, even like 10 years ago. It's like, I can see, with running and things, you know, it's like the times I do now are definitely, they're starting to slow down, so there's less kind of physical energy there. But there's a sense of being able to tap into, for want of a better way of putting it, deeper and deeper sort of reservoirs of energy, which are which we all have available. Well, we don't have, which are all potentially there to be tapped into, but because it's so easy to just kind of end up living on the surface of ourselves, we don't always get to. So I feel like since that retreat, I've been able to tap more deeply into those. And a lot of it is about that sense of, you know, being separate that we have. As long as there's a sense of, you know, me at the centre of the world and having to keep everything else kind of at bay, except for the bits that we want to kind of pull towards us, that really limits the kind of amount of energy that you can access, because it's almost like you're putting up a subtle shield, as it were, to the energy that surrounds you.
Mm-hmm.
So when that goes, if that disappears, then there's a sense, I don't know how to put this without it sounding sort of mystical, because I don't feel in the least mystical, but there's a sense of being able to draw on energy, whether it's the energy of nature or it's I suppose also realizing that everything actually, all experience is an experience of awareness and an experience of mind, also has a real effect on how you experience energy and what that can do. So yeah, things have changed, I think, in the last 10 years or so. And a lot of it was just building on, you know, all that I received from Bante and other old members and other people, you know, over the years. So, but I think, for me it feels as if those 3 years, just with all that time to really be able to just, you know, completely focus on it, did sort of liberate things, or, you know, bring to fruition a lot of seeds that have been planted by Bante and other people over a long period of time. We got a good watering over those 3 years. Good watering every day makes a difference.
So where we start, we were talking about looking back over your Dharma life, and you mentioned these couple of particular points, the time in Croydon and then the time being Bante Secretary, and then we kind of made a bit of a leap through various ways, and we've talked about the last 10 years. Just wondering, in terms of that, looking back on that landscape, are there any other particular things that you'd mention? Or do you think we've covered the main things that are occurring to you this afternoon? I mean, that's the other point, Another afternoon, they might, the cloudscape might be different and different things would be revealed, I guess.
Yeah. I think when you talk about your life story, it all depends how you're feeling now. You know, so if you're feeling low, then, you know, your life story just explains, you know, how everything went wrong, you know, to get to this point. But if today's a good day, then your life story is a different life story, because it's telling the story of how you got to this moment, which is a good moment. I don't know. I have very fond memories of living at Gokhyaloka in some ways. After I left being Bante's secretary, I spent a bit of time in London because I was also chair of Aid for India, which became the Karunar Trust. But then I moved out to Gokhyaloka, and that's where I wrote the first draft of Meeting the Buddhas. And that felt like a very special time in my life, because I was just part of a little community with Dharmavira and Antadarshan and Dharmapala. Most of that time, although I was leading the men's ordination courses, I led all the men's ordination courses through the 80s. I organised the 81 and 82 ones, with Bante sort of leading from the, but very much leading from the back, as it were, and then I led 83 to 89. But yes, that time in Gokhyaloka where I was writing Meeting the Buddhas felt very like a real privilege, because when I wasn't doing the ordination courses, I was mainly just focusing on that world of these different figures. And to be able to live like that was, again, it was a very deepening experience, both trying to go as deeply as I could into the experience of the practice in order to, you know, I didn't want to just give people information about the figures. I wanted to give them some sense of what the figures were about and what it might be like, you know, how the practice could unfold some feeling for Madhusattva or whoever it was, not just, you know, here's his mantra and, he's white and he's like this. And then I was also trying to express my feeling for those figures and the information and everything as clearly and as well as I could, and that was in writing, and that was a whole process in itself. And it was the first book that I wrote, which was quite something to start with, which was also Bante's idea, actually. So that was a very special time, just again, I suppose it was going back to my name. It was going into this inner world and kind of dwelling, finding one of these incredibly rich Buddhist figures and dwelling with them and meditating on them, and then trying to share it through writing about them as well as I could. It's a lovely way to try and give. Yes, that was a special time.
Edimala had a question, which is an interesting, very strict question, actually, which is, what does going for refuge to the Three Jewels mean to you?
Oh, it means as much as possible having a great big open heart to life, which also involves seeing it as clearly as possible, but seeing how it is, but seeing it with love.
So I have one more question, which I mentioned earlier, and in a way maybe you've already just answered it, but it was to do with looking to the future. If you were able to leave a message or a term, a teaching or an image for future Dharma farers to find, what might that be?
You might have to sit and gaze out the window for a minute. Thanks a lot. Don't know. Maybe I'll write you something. A few lines.
I asked you the question because it was there at the end and we'd mentioned it at the start, but in a way I almost felt like you answered it with your answer to the previous question. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
I've enjoyed doing this. I'm really pleased that you're going to get 50 voices and and I hope that we can keep collecting experiences of different people who've been around. And I'm very aware, just in the last few months, Malikar, who I was ordained with, has died, and Chinamanda, Surina, they're all people who've got experience from the early days of Trinidad. I think the more of that we can collect, the better. Because everything arises in dependence on conditions, then it's not just, that's interesting old stuff about the early days. Quite a lot of, I can still see in Sri Ratna strands and tendencies which have carried on from the early days. And in some cases, they're not particularly appropriate now, but they've carried on because they were appropriate back then. And nobody's actually decided right now that's not the right emphasis so much. Bhante has been, he has been amazing at kind of steering things and trying to see, how the currents of the times and within society and within Sri Ratna, what directions they're taking things in, and he's trying to sort of steer and give guidance and pointers to keep us on track, so to speak. And listening to him answering questions back in the 70s and 80s, I often felt like he was, it was like trying to line something up. If it's 2 degrees out now, that doesn't matter in 10 years or 20 years, but over 200 years, that's a big divergence, and so you try to get it dead on. I think the more of people's early experiences of Tiratna we gather, the more we'll understand the conditions. functioning forces which are formed through Ratna, which are still playing out in different ways.
Mm.
So I think it's valuable from that point of view. Mm.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Mm.